Mr. Barnett and Mr. Shannable. Good morning, Mr. Barnett.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Barnett, would you care to reserve any of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
5 minutes, Your Honor.
All right, and then we'll be glad to hear from you when you're ready.
And may it please the court, Judge, I am Stephen Barnett. I'm here representing Mr. White. Mr. White was convicted in the Gloucester Circuit Court of one count of willfully intentionally making material false statement on a firearm application. Judge Shaw then sentenced him under the class 5 felony to 6 months with all 6 months suspended. The assignment of error here arises from the trial court failing to exercise the discretion that's granted to it.
Well, let me interrupt you and ask you about preservation of that issue. Were you trial counsel in this case?
I was, Judge.
Well, I noticed that from the record that there was a guilty plea entered and a request for a pre-sentence report, and the only request I see from you in that connection was a request to defer a finding until after the pre-sentence report had been heard. And then it looked like the trial court, Judge Shaw, basically, I think in response to your statement to the effect of there should be some way to avoid a felony conviction for this gentleman because of his age and other circumstances, Judge Shaw took that, I guess, as a sort of a request for a deferred finding and then declined to do so, but there was no objection ever entered after that, was there? So I guess my question would simply be, where is this error even preserved?
Judge, as far as that goes, initially, even in the written plea agreement, if you review the record, there was in the agreement itself that the defense would be asking for a withheld findings based on a pre-sentence report. The Commonwealth did not object to that withheld findings pending the pre-sentence report, and then at that point, the Commonwealth would be asking for a finding of guilt.
I interpret that to mean pending, you know, until a pre-sentence report is prepared.
Correct.
Hold the finding of guilt until a pre-sentence report is prepared.
I don't disagree with that.
So, and that was done.
That was done.
So, and then when the trial court declined to withhold a finding any further, no objection was made, was there?
At that point, Judge, I guess looking at it, some more discussions would have been appropriate. The judge had referenced Taylor in his holding, saying that he didn't feel that Taylor overruled Stars. And Taylor wasn't a case that I had read.
Well,
it'd
be the other way around because they're a higher court. But
I understood that.
The judge said Stars didn't overrule Taylor.
Stars didn't overrule Taylor. And Stars was a case I was a little bit more familiar with, and procedurally, it posture-wise, is the same position that Mr. White was in. In Taylor, an order had been entered adjudicating Ms. Taylor guilty.
Well, I get all that. My simple question is, there was no objection when the judge didn't do that, so how is it preserved?
I think that the preservation comes in through the request, Judge.
What action did you specifically ask the trial court to take at sentencing?
Judge, I did not ask for a specific action. I asked the judge to consider any alternative, which is what is laid out in the pre-sentence reports. They have alternative options, and even on the sentencing form.
Is there a lesser offense, another offense? Did you ask that he acquit him altogether? I mean, what is the error of the trial court?
Well, Judge, certainly he could have, I'll make up something, required him to complete a firearm safety class, seek a pardon from the governor.
And then do what?
And reduce it to 18 to 186, a misdemeanor making a statement to obtain property.
I think you're making the point that Judge Petty and I are trying to get at here, it seems to be. Where's the trial court error when you don't ask the trial court for anything specific and then you argue on appeal the trial court did something wrong by not doing something, even though you never really asked for anything specific?
Well, Judge, I would say this. In the line of cases, in Stars, he was asking for something specific. He was asking for an acquittal.
Right.
In the other cases, Taylor, she was just asking for something other than a felony, which is with the same position that Mr. White was in, and that's what I asked the judge for, to consider some alternative other than, I think I said, tagging him or hitting him with a felony at his age. And Judge Shaw seemed to take that argument, and having been there and seeing him on the bench, and I think he struggled a bit with it, seemed to take that argument well. And in his comments, that had this been a case where statutorily he had the option, that he would seriously consider that. But again, he went with the holding that Stars did not overrule Taylor, and that's kind of what brings us here today.
Well, let's discuss that question, because it seems to be somewhat open right now. We've got a long line of cases. Hernandez, what's the case out of Moreau, and then we get to Taylor. And I was on the panel, Taylor, so I guess you can kind of understand what I think about the issue.
I understand.
But Taylor was appealed, and the Supreme Court denied a writ. And when Stars was issued, Stars never specifically addressed or overruled Taylor.
It did not, Judge.
So why isn't the judge correct that Taylor, having not been overruled, is still to some extent good law?
Well, I think where the issue comes in again is the procedural differences between Stars and Taylor. Taylor had been found guilty. An order had been entered, and I think that was on May 9th. Of 2009, May 18th, the judge entered a finding. At that point, there is no argument whatsoever to be made that it is out of the judge's hands and what he can do at that point, except to proceed on to sentencing within the guidelines as prescribed by statute. In Stars and in White, the procedural posture was different. No finding had been made when the request was made. Wade had not been convicted of any crime. And that's where I think the major difference between Taylor and Stars comes in. The Supreme Court said that in between the period of taking it under advisement and the actual pronouncing of sentence, the trial court retains inherent authority to consider any disposition other than to impose the legislatively prescribed punishment, including...
Wouldn't that presumptively mean any legitimate disposition, correct?
Yes, Judge, any legitimate disposition.
But Stars, there's a lot of language in Stars, I think, that suggests that the trial court serves as a super legislature and a super executive branch in terms of administering justice as opposed to just finding guilt or innocence. But the bottom line in Stars is it dealt with whether the trial court had some jurisdiction or some authority to address the issue upon a plea of guilty. I mean, for the reasons stated, we conclude that the circuit court's accepting and entering Starr's guilty pleas in a written order was not a formal adjudication of guilt. Thus, the trial court erred in concluding that it no longer had inherent authority to consider any disposition other than the legislative described punishment.
Correct.
Now here, we're talking, I mean, assuming that the argument is preserved, we're talking about not imposing the punishment, but in fact absolving the defendant of criminal liability altogether.
I don't know that we're getting to the point of absolving of criminal liability altogether, because there was no specific request for that. But that is exactly the same thing that happened in this case. An order was, the guilty pleas were accepted, but there was no order adjudicating him guilty. That's why I say Stars and White are procedurally identical.
So I mean, the trial court, in saying that I don't have any authority to even consider your question, is one thing. The argument that you now have authority to dismiss the charge, to basically vacate the guilty plea, that's not addressed in Stars, but is addressed in Taylor.
It is, Judge.
I mean, the Stars says, oh, yeah, you can continue the case, you can continue it and consider requests, but it doesn't go say what you can really do, because it's not the issue in Stars. Taylor addresses that.
Well, I believe what the court said is that it can consider punishment, including to consider an outcome other than a felony conviction.
It can consider it.
It can consider it.
But can it do it?
And that's what we're really here about. And let me say this. I think the Commonwealth absolutely nailed this entire case in their brief. On page 15, footnote 7, the last sentence says, of course, the trial court could have exercised its discretion, conceding that it does have discretion, and denied White's request. And had Judge Shaw simply said, I've considered your request, I deny your request, I don't think that we're here today, because that is the court saying, I do have this discretion, I recognize I have this discretion, but I'm going to decline to exercise it. That's fine.
Let me throw another stink bomb into this line of cases, and that's our post-Starrs opinion in Harris. Now, Harris seems to suggest that Starrs does not say what you arguing it says, but that, in effect, once again, going back to bootstrap Taylor and say Taylor is actually the law of the case. What do we do with Harris?
Well, Judge, my reading of Harris, the judge was asked to withhold the findings or consider some other outcome, and he said no. And that right there is exactly where we would have been had Judge Shaw simply said, I'm not going to exercise my discretion.
But Harris goes on and says, the record shows that the trial court exercised authority to consider and deny defense counsel's request. But then it says, the scope of this appeal reaches the actual merits of the deferred disposition request, and goes on to talk about whether there was authority, the court had the authority to do it at all. So it's kind of, it says the trial court didn't err by denying the request, but it then goes on to say, but we're gonna point out that Starrs doesn't allow him to do it anyway.
I would say that my reading of it, and again, the cases do kind of get a little munged together, for lack of a better word, and I had a difficult time last night when I was trying to map them out. It looked like a West Virginia family tree to me, is that...
That's usually not very hard to map out.
My dad's from West Virginia. I can make that comment. Starrs is the controlling case here. And again, if the judge simply said, Mr. Barnett, I understand your argument. I feel for this man. I'd love to do something different. I'm going to decline their exercising discretion. There would be nothing to appeal.
But Harris concludes with, the narrow authority to take a matter under advisement or defer a disposition is neither a gateway nor a loophole for acquitting or refusing to convict a defendant whose guilt has been established beyond a reasonable doubt.
And I think that's also addressed in Starrs when they talk about getting into peniology as well.
But that statement to me says the court couldn't do it anyway. That statement to me says Starrs doesn't really mean what a lot of us thought it meant.
And I guess that leaves us, and hopefully maybe that's why Judge Shaw said, I invite you to bring me
well,
a case
maybe,
on my
maybe, this, maybe this will get up to the Supreme Court and they can clarify it. But I think Judge Petty's point, which I totally agree with, is if you read, there's a lot of different ways to read Starrs. Starrs, I think, is almost a tour de force of an opinion saying not a lot, but implying quite a bit. And so, I mean, Starrs stops short of saying essentially that it doesn't matter if the case has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, courts can do any damn thing they want to. It doesn't say that, but that's the way a lot of lawyers are arguing it. And, you know, it seems to me a narrow reading of Starrs is simply that until a final order is entered, you know, and the 21-day rule has elapsed, the court has the authority and the jurisdiction to do anything a court could legally do, you know, in any particular set of circumstances. So, for example, I don't know that I would read Starrs as giving the court the authority to override a jury verdict of guilt on a greater offense to reduce it to a lesser offense just arbitrarily because the court just feels like, you know, the policy of the Commonwealth is too harsh. I mean, I don't read Starrs as enabling something on that order. Do you?
I don't necessarily disagree with you, and I guess that gets into the whole issue of judicial activism, things of that nature. But in reading
that's
STARS.
That's something the legislature is really strong on, I'm sure you're aware.
Well, you run into this kind of dichotomy here where the legislature says you can't do these things, and the Supreme Court says, in my interpretation of it, I am defense counsel, yes, you can, and the legislature says, no, you can't, and the Supreme Court, which is the boss, says, yes, you can. And
you may be correct in your interpretation that until the Supreme Court actually resolves this dilemma, trial courts, this court, are going to be shaking their head over what exactly the state of the law is. But I will point out that the batting order has changed somewhat in the Supreme Court, and I note that Justice Kelsey wrote Taylor and was on Harris. So you may find that the leadoff batters are a lot stronger if it goes up.
Just Penny and I beat you up pretty good with questions, so I'm going to give you an extra minute in rebuttal. So.
And just the only, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Chandler?
Ms. Chandler, I understand your argument on preservation. I mean, it's pretty straightforward, and I guess it's just a matter of determining what actually transpired and to what extent the issue was preserved. So I wonder if you didn't address the merits of this in your argument, and it's the merits, at least from your point of view, that I'm most interested in. Where are we with this series of cases?
At the risk of disagreeing with the court in a circumstance where I might strategically should be agreeing with the court, I actually think that, at least on brief, opposing counsel is absolutely right about the state of the law. Where I think he is wrong is in the way that he represents the record and statements he makes about what was and was not preserved in the record, because I do not think the argument that's made on appeal is the argument that was preserved below.
So your position is that if we disagree with you on the preservation issue, this case should be reversed and remanded?
For consideration by the judge whether or not he intends to exercise his discretion under STARS and under Harris. And the reason I have reached that conclusion after a careful reading of all of these cases, which made my head hurt as much as anyone else's, even in Harris, when the Court of Appeals reads the STARS holding very narrowly and says, no, we're not going to read STARS to mean that you can just continue to defer disposition indefinitely, even in the circumstance where the evidence has established that this defendant is guilty. If the evidence establishes that he's guilty, you have to convict. But what the court said in Harris is that there is this small exception in cases where the evidence that's put on at the deferred disposition hearing goes to a defendant's guilt or innocence. And the way that my opposing counsel has presented the argument he made below, the way he's presented on appeal, he argues that, listen, this evidence did go to my client's guilt or innocence. Thus, even under Harris, this is the very narrow, rare circumstance where a trial court can defer disposition and consider alternatives if the court is convinced that maybe this defendant really is not guilty, maybe he really is innocent. So when presented in that light, the court did have the discretion. However, my opposing counsel at trial never argued that this evidence, this testimony, is evidence of his innocence. Never mentioned the criminal intent element. Never argued that the court should acquit. Never tried to controvert his prior guilty plea where he accepted, I'm pleading guilty because I am, in fact, guilty.
The clear purpose of 518 is to ensure that the trial court has an opportunity to make a ruling on the issue that is presented to us. They get to swing at it before we get to call it balls or strikes. It is abundantly clear to me in this record that Judge Shaw knew exactly what was being requested. There is absolutely no reason for him to discuss Taylor or STARS if he didn't understand that there was a request to either reduce or reduce the conviction or to dismiss it altogether. Why shouldn't that be the dispositive issue on whether it has been preserved?
So here's where I would disagree with Your Honor, respectfully. I
think that's just Your Honor, just me.
Yes.
Don't put me on that limb with him.
Yes, Your Honor. Singular. I do think it's clear that the trial judge knew that he was being asked to exercise authority under STARS to basically grant an act of judicial clemency. to say, even though I found you guilty, even though you've entered a guilty plea, even though you've accepted that the facts are sufficient to prove your guilt, I'm going to exercise some sort of judicial grace to defer disposition here. I think that's what, on the basis of this record, the trial court thought the question presented to it was. On appeal, the way it's been presented is, we asked the trial court to consider this evidence of my client's innocence, and based on this evidence of innocence, recognize there's an exception in Harris that would allow him to do this.
Here's my, and this is, may not be this case, but here's the tension that I see, maybe you can address it. I read Starrs to say, basically, that a court can do what a court can do. You know, and it says it pretty much that nebulously, I think. But courts in different contexts can do different things. They can reopen cases based on newly discovered evidence, provided they still have jurisdiction. They can reduce to a lesser included offense if the evidence supports that, or arguably even if the evidence doesn't support it. We don't typically go behind those things. What we don't have, though, are situations that where appellate courts have addressed the authority or ability of a trial court to ignore things like guilty pleas or jury verdicts to do what you refer to as an act of judicial grace. Mm-hmm. I question, frankly, whether there is any authority for that, and certainly whether Starrs necessarily offers authority for something like that. Now, This may or may not be that case. It's pretty doggone close to it, given the guilty plea situation. And assuming it's preserved, you know, I understand your concession to be this needs to be reversed. That, of course, concession is not binding on this court, and I'm frankly not persuaded by it because of the way I read Starrs. But Starrs, I don't think I think it's anything but a bright line rule. I'll put it that way. Taylor is a lot brighter. Harris is a lot brighter because they deal with specific situations, and Supreme Court has not overruled either of those scenarios expressly, nor do I suggest even implicitly with Starrs. So the question for me, I guess, as one member of this panel, and why I'm not, you know, linking arms with Judge Petty here, is I'm not sure whether or not your concession that Starrs controls this is that situation. Maybe you can address that.
Well, I think under Starrs and under Harris, the trial court had the discretion to do what my opposing counsel is now claiming on appeal for the first time the trial court should have done. In Harris, the court interprets Starrs, and this is at the bottom of page 535 in Harris. And the court says, significantly, however, and this is this court speaking in Harris, the Supreme Court qualified its holding in Starrs when it stated that the purpose of hearing additional evidence is to determine whether an accused is guilty or not and the measure of guilt. So in other words, there is this narrow class of cases where a trial court does have the authority to defer a disposition and consider alternatives.
Well, a court can always defer a disposition, certainly at least for a reasonable amount of time, because until it enters a final order, nothing is carved in stone.
Right.
So that, I mean, to the extent that that's a broad statement, I think that's clearly true. I think where it gets more problematic is where a request is made to do something that undermines some other aspect of the judicial process,
right,
in an arbitrary way. You referred to it as judicial grace. It might be judicial activism in somebody else's mind, but nonetheless, clearly there's a broad authority for the courts to exercise their power to do certain things, but there are limits on it. I don't think Starrs removes those limits.
And I absolutely agree with the court on that statement. I do not think the trial court...
One of the problems here, however, and this follows up, I guess, in Judge Petty's point, is that in determining whether the trial court error occurred in the failure to exercise discretion, one of the problems I have is I don't know what was being requested in the first place. It was sort of a jump ball. It's, you know, judge, do something for my client. I don't care what, you know, don't, you know, something less than what's going to happen to him according to law. And the judge basically said, I don't have the discretion to do that. The question for us is that error? And I'm not sure it was.
So as I read Starrs and Harris, I do think that even under this court's opinion decision in Harris, a trial court does have the authority to decline to enter a finding of guilt in the limited class of cases where at that deferred disposition, the defendant puts on evidence of his innocence And the trial judge basically changes his mind and says, well, a month ago I was going to accept your guilty plea and find you guilty, but now you've come forward with new evidence that you're actually innocent. And so at that point, the judge doesn't have to enter a finding of guilt. If the judge is convinced, perhaps this
But see, that's not radical, because it shortcuts the process, but it's akin to saying, judge, I've got some newly discovered evidence here. I would like to withdraw my guilty plea. You know, so you combine those two things, which the court can already do, already clearly has the authority to do, and you get to the same place. That's quite different from just pleading guilty and then saying, I'm pleading guilty, judge. I have nothing to offer in the way of newly discovered evidence. I'm not claiming I'm innocent. Just don't convict me, even though that's what the law requires. That's where I question whether or not STARS authorizes something like that.
Exactly. I absolutely agree with everything you just said. And I think that is why the way the argument is made in the trial court and the way the issue is preserved in the trial court is so important. If the defendant only argues in the trial court, listen, Your Honor, this is a 60-year-old man. He made an honest mistake. Please exercise some judicial grace, defer his position, and consider some alternative to a felony conviction. The trial court does not have the authority under STARS to enter a finding basically of judicial grace.
And of course, the legislature has given the courts the authority to exercise judicial grace, as you refer to it, mm-hmm. in certain specific circumstances.
Yes,
but they've done that through their policymaking authority.
Yes, Your Honor. So that specific argument is a completely different argument that this is actually
let me bring you back to what you said. Does not have the inherent authority to consider an act of judicial grace. Now, STARS doesn't specifically address dismissing the case, but it clearly says the court can exercise judicial grace in convicting the accused of a lesser offense or to consider an outcome other than a felony conviction.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that's exactly the act of judicial grace that the defendant was requesting. Fashion a remedy to this rather than hitting this man with a felony at 60 years old. That, to me, says I'm basically asking you to find some misdemeanor you can convict him of.
Right. And no court has yet reached the issue of what are the options after the trial court deferred disposition for some period of time. Can the court acquit? Can the court find guilty of a lesser included offense? Can the court order some sort of community service?
Well, we have. We clearly did that in Taylor.
Well, the Supreme Court has not yet reached that ultimate issue.
Yeah,
what this court has said is, no, those options are not on the table, except for in those rare classes of cases where the evidence presented at the deferred disposition hearing goes to guilt or innocence. And that statement is made throughout the Harris opinion, that this is not that narrow class of cases. At the end of the opinion, in the conclusion, this court in Harris notes that his counsel offered no defense or argument against the charge, failed to state any proper purpose for the request to take the matter under advisement. Any proper purpose, i.e., a purpose relevant to determining guilt or innocence and the degree of guilt. So that's a proper purpose. So if that is the reason why the evidence of the defendant's testimony was offered at the trial level here, to prove his guilt or innocence, then the court did have the authority to defer disposition and consider alternative dispositions ultimately. But he never presented it as evidence of innocence.
In the context of what happened, let's set the guilty plea thing aside for a moment. I mean, in bench trial situation, which happens a lot in Virginia, the judge sits as the fact finder, as well as the trial court as the finder of the law, and can do what a jury can do. And just like with a jury, we don't second guess decisions by the trial court to find guilt for lesser included offenses if the evidence is presented and contested and so forth. And I think that's what STARS addresses, you know, the fact that courts can do that. So while I as the prosecutor or you as the defense attorney might have a different conclusion about what the evidence supports by way of a conviction, the appellate courts are not going to second guess the fact finder's conclusion in that regard. But that's a very different situation from a trial court who is not sitting as a fact finder, and where a defendant enters a guilty plea and there's no evidence offered up to the contrary, or a jury reaching a verdict and there's no reason to set it aside because none has been offered, for the trial court to arbitrarily do those things which the court could otherwise do in the right set of circumstances. So I think one way to read STARS is simply saying that language Judge Petty just quoted is a recitation of things that trial courts have the authority, the inherent authority to do in various scenarios, but not necessarily in all scenarios.
Right, and I would agree with that reading of Starbridge and Harris.
Would you agree, particularly listening to your discussion with Judge Humphreys and the trial court's exasperation in this case, it almost would be a manifest injustice for us not to decide this case on the merits so that the courts of this commonwealth will understand what authority they have and what authority they don't have.
I don't think that would be necessary.
How in the world do the trial courts deal with this?
I mean,
we're debating it.
Reading the case law made my head hurt, but I would also submit that it can be harmonized. The conclusion from Harris and from Starrs is that a trial court cannot indefinitely defer disposition and then acquit a defendant, ultimately dismiss the charges, if the evidence is still sufficient to prove that defendant's guilt.
But would you agree with me that there are courts of this commonwealth that think that is part of their inherent authority?
I think that there are. And I think that in writing an opinion that explains the differences between asking a judge to exercise judicial grace, which under Harris a judge cannot do, and on the other hand, asking a judge to consider new evidence of innocence, and in that circumstance to consider maybe finding the defendant guilty of a lesser included offense because that's all the evidence would have supported, those are two very different things. And so preserving the issue in the trial court, you have to make sure that you fall in the latter box and not the former. And in this case, the defense counsel argued and submitted to the court. He said, I told, this is page 39 of the appendix, I told my client, when you wrote no on that form, that's where the crime was completed. That's where it was done. So he's conceding, my defendant is guilty of a crime, but I'm asking you to defer disposition anyway.
Just one additional question. I see your time's running short, but I do want to get your position on this. And that's Harris. Harris troubles me a lot because it's post-Starrs, and it is at least in conflict or arguable conflict with Starrs. But Harris was a case where the trial court specifically considered and denied the request. And we recognized that. I mean, we said the trial court actually denied that request in emphasis in italics on the merits. Well, that's an abuse of discretion call, which is pretty much a no-brainer in this case. But then the court goes on to talk about what the court could have done had it not decided the case on the merits. My question to you is, isn't all of that dicta?
I think you can make the case that all of that is dicta.
Thank you.
I would argue that even the narrowest reading of what a trial court is allowed to do in these circumstances is, at the very most, the trial court can defer disposition and consider alternatives based on new evidence of innocence. But it has to be presented as evidence of innocence. And the trial court says, Taylor still applies, and for that reason, I do not find I have the authority to do this. It was incumbent upon defense counsel to respond and say, Taylor does not apply because this case is distinguishable because I'm presenting new evidence of innocence, and that's the basis for your authority to do what I'm asking you to do. Since he did not make that argument, it was not preserved. We ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chandler. Well, Mr. Burnett, I'll give you a minute in rebuttal.
And listening to the line of questioning there made my head hurt a little bit too. And I understand the frustration here in some of the questions that are coming forward. I do view Starrs as a bright line rule. I do view, as Judge Petty said, when the Supreme Court says that the court has the inherent authority to consider any disposition other than to impose the legislatively prescribed punishment, including to consider an outcome other than a felony conviction.
But Mr. Chandoval's argument, which makes sense, is that you can convict him of a lesser included offense, but you have to show some evidence to support that request.
And I think that the evidence presented at the sentencing, which I want to concede, wasn't to show that he was innocent of this. Mr. White had said, I did this. The actual physical act of doing this made me guilty. But when we went through what he had been presented with, and you can read the arguments in there, that every document he had to a layperson said assault and battery. Every last document, his conviction order from Matthews, his criminal background check that his employer ran, said assault and battery. Now, did it have this code section under 18.257.2? I believe the order from Matthews did. that was what the evidence was, to show the judge, and we're talking about mitigation, which I think is talked about in Kyber, the degree of culpability, the degree of the egregious conduct here. If a convicted murderer walks into Hunter's Haven down in Gloucester and tries to buy a gun, knowing that he's a convicted felon, I think we're in a totally different posture.
Suppose as Judge Humphreys question, suppose this were a jury verdict instead of a guilty plea, and you were at sentencing, would your argument be the same?
Yes. Absolutely.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
On that note,